It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. In his first statement since an Iraqi offensive to recapture Mosul was launched 2 weeks ago, Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi called on the city's IS defenders to resist the Iraqi advance, calling it a prelude to victory. The audio message also urged IS jihadists not to retreat and called on militants to hold their ground. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley of the University of New South Wales was asked whether it's possible Baghdadi is still in Mosul.
I know that a lot of people did flee. He's been so secretive that we basically haven't had much of an idea where he is. I'm sure if the U.S. knew where he was, he'd be he'd have been dealt with by now.
The Iraqi Special Forces reportedly have consolidated gains made Tuesday after entering the eastern neighborhoods of Mosul. Hundreds of civilians, some with white flags, have left their neighborhoods, with one relief agency warning more than a million people are in grave danger. Many, like Ali Hamid, have made their way to refugee camps where he recounted that rule violations under IS captors resulted often in beatings or being pushed off buildings. He said anyone found to be a spy or policeman would be decapitated. Kenya has announced it's withdrawing its troops from the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan after the Kenyan commander was sacked following accusations the 16,000-strong UNMISS peacekeeping force failed to respond adequately to ethnic violence in July. A UN report made public Tuesday over allegations that UN forces allowed gross rights violations to take place resulted in the removal of Lieutenant General Johnson Magoha Kamani Ondieki by the UN Secretary General. Nairobi said it rejects the findings of the UN report for lacking in transparency and not providing Nairobi input. This is VOA News. In U.S. politics, the two main presidential candidates Wednesday campaigned in states seen as crucial to victory in next Tuesday's election. Both Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump were in Florida Wednesday. Trump addressed supporters in Pensacola.
In 6 days, we are going to win the great state of Florida. And we are going to win the White House. Going to win it.
President Obama campaigned for Clinton in North Carolina, saying the Republican nominee is unfit to be the nation's leader.
This guy is temperamentally unfit to be commander-in-chief, and he is not equipped to be president.
Clinton also campaigned in Nevada Wednesday. Polls show a tightening race in the final days. The Russian Defense Ministry says that it will observe a humanitarian pause of about 10 hours Friday to allow both rebels and civilians to leave the embattled Syrian city of Aleppo. The chief of Russia's general staff said the moratorium, which was also approved by Syrian officials, is intended to avoid pointless casualties. The Obama administration issued fresh criticism of the Israeli decision to issue building permits for dozens of new homes in East Jerusalem. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
In just the past few weeks, we have seen reports of an entirely new settlement near Shiloh, a potentially new settlement outpost in the North Jordan Valley, and over 80 Palestinian structures demolished in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. These actions risk entrenching a one-state reality and raise serious questions about Israel's ultimate commitment to a peaceful negotiated settlement of the Palestinians.
The Palestinians claim East Jerusalem as a future capital. The U.S. government has called for restoration of full humanitarian access to the restive Western Rakhine State in Myanmar, known as Burma. Ambassador Scott Marciel was joined with the U.N. resident coordinator for Myanmar and other chiefs of mission on a two-day visit to villages in the state. Pierre Perron is with the U.N. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
At the moment, children who are malnourished, who we've identified, who we've started treating and supporting, who've had their assistance stopped overnight. And that's very much a concern. It's terrible.
Rights groups have raised alarm over a three-week security campaign in which homes have been burned and some killings have taken place. Militants in Nigeria's Niger Delta attacked an oil pipeline operated by the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation a day after President Muhammadu Buhari met local leaders in a bid to end such attacks that have helped push the West African nation's economy into recession. The National League Chicago Cubs won pivotal Game 7 of the Professional Baseball World Series Championship late Wednesday, defeating the Cleveland Indians 8-7, their first championship in 108 years. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya says it is withdrawing its troops from the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan.
In a statement late Wednesday, Kenya's foreign ministry said they would immediately withdraw all Kenyan troops serving in the UN mission in South Sudan, of which there are about 1,000.
That's VOA's Margaret Bashir at the United Nations. Some South Sudanese say the sacking of the UN peacekeeping force commander in South Sudan is long overdue. The African Union is urged to jumpstart the establishment of a hybrid court in South Sudan. And South African President Jacob Zuma faces growing calls to resign for alleged corruption in his government.
We can proceed with making sure we hold Jacob Zuma to account and that the people of South Africa will know the absolute truth. It's time now that we take deliberate action as the people of our country.
Musi Maimane is leader of the opposition Democratic Alliance Party of South Africa. Experts say countries that are democratic tend to offer the best environment for their national minorities to succeed. And preventing infections during surgery can save millions of lives every year. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's Africa Sports Roundup and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya says it will pull its peacekeeping force from South Sudan a day after UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon fired the Kenyan general who is the force commander of the UN mission in South Sudan. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
An internal UN investigation blamed a lack of leadership on the part of key senior mission personnel for the chaotic and ineffective response to fighting that killed some 300 people in July in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. On Tuesday, when those findings were released, the UN said it would immediately replace Lieutenant General Johnson Muchai Kemani Ondieki of Kenya, the force commander of the UN mission in South Sudan known as UNMISS. Ban Ki-moon appointed Ondieki in May, and he took up his post in mid-June. The violence that erupted around Juba's presidential palace began on July 8th. In a statement late Wednesday, Kenya's foreign ministry rejected the general's dismissal and the UN's offer to nominate a replacement. The ministry said they would immediately withdraw all Kenyan troops serving in the UN mission in South Sudan, of which there are about 1,000. Kenya also said it will discontinue plans to contribute troops to a regional protection force in South Sudan and will disengage from the peace process. UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric said the UN has not yet received official notice from the Kenyan government, but said that their contribution to peacekeeping is valued. The deputy force commander, who is Chinese, is currently serving as interim commander. China also came in for criticism in the investigation for the actions of one of its commanders and a battalion that at least twice abandoned its position protecting civilians in Juba. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
South Sudanese analysts say UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's decision to sack the UN peacekeeping force commander is long overdue. Zachariah Deng, a policy analyst at the Juba-based SALT Institute, says the United Nations and the government must cooperate more so that they can build trust between the two institutions and help the country move forward. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
The UN report concluded its peacekeeping force in South Sudan failed to protect civilians and aid workers when fighting broke out in Juba in July. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon fired UNMISS Force Commander Lieutenant General Johnson Mogoa Kimani of Kenya following the report's release. Political analyst Jacob Chol says UNMISS has weaknesses that hinder it from effectively carrying out its mandate.
These basically are issues to do with the commanding, issues to do with, you know, logistic, issues to do with basically the troop contributing countries and so on and so forth. So the report basically brought out what exactly has been the cry for the South Sudanese, that there should be a strong United Nations mission in South Sudan that should protect civilians at the critical time of the violence.
Chol says the UN chief should have sacked junior commanders earlier in states like Jonglei, Upper Nile and Unity, which witnessed massive violence against civilians in 2013. He says the incoming regional protection force leadership should strive to understand the history that led to South Sudan's conflict and its ethnic differences in order to play a meaningful role.
You need a leader who's very strong enough, a leader who understands the violence in South Sudan and the violence in the sub-Saharan Africa, especially the Great Horn of Africa. A leader who has worked before there and he has fought in the war in the Great Horn of Africa. You need a leader actually who have troops together with him from his country or her country. So that now, when a critical time comes, like what happened in 8th July, his own troop from his mother country will not be able to leave him when he command.
Zakaria Ding Akol, a policy analyst at the Juba-based Sud Institute, says since the breakout of violence in December 2013, the government has had a poor relationship with the UN. Akol says both parties need to rebuild trust and cooperate more, but acknowledges that the primary responsibility of protecting civilians lies with the government.
We know the relationship between the government and the UN has not been very good for some time, especially since the war broke out. There's an issue of trust that the two sides have to overcome. The UN needs the cooperation of the government of South Sudan, and the government of South Sudan needs the UN support.
But Franco Riak Atem, a second-year student of economics at the University of Juba, who says he lost family members during the July fighting, commends the UN Secretary's decision to sack Lieutenant General Kimani.
This is their mandate here. So, and if it is their mandate, they should have to do it the way that they have come here. Because they have not come here in order, if they have got something very dangerous, they run away. Like now the one who is being removed, he failed to do his mandate. We wanted the other guy who is going to come in order that to make a good move rather than that guy.
South Sudan's Deputy Information Minister Akol Paul Kordit declined to be interviewed regarding the UN report, saying he could not comment on UN's internal matters. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Dozens of national and international human rights organizations have petitioned the African Union to jumpstart the process of establishing a hybrid court in South Sudan, as required by the 2015 peace agreement. The group say if a hybrid court was up and running, it will help deter more violence across South Sudan. YK Simon Wudu reports from Nairobi.
The petition addressed to African Union Chairperson Kozazana Lamini Zuma calls on the AU to proceed with drafting the statute of the court. The rights groups say delaying the process of establishing the hybrid court any further will deny victims justice. Elizabeth Deng, a researcher with Amnesty International, one of the groups that signed the petition, says evidence of crimes is being lost or destroyed because of the delayed formation of the court. She says prolonging the process may endanger its efficiency in addressing abuses committed during the conflict.
The fact that conflict is continuing and that human rights violations are continuing is just another reason why the hybrid court needs to be established with urgency.
Establishment of the hybrid court is mandated in the 2015 peace agreement aimed at bringing justice to victims of atrocities since the conflict broke out in late December 2013. Deng says despite little to no progress on forming the court, the United States government recently sent more than $3 million to the African Union to start establishing the hybrid court. Deng says people suspected of committing war crimes may try to deter prosecutors by threatening and harassing victims and witnesses of the court. But she says the court will face challenges, but those challenges can be confronted by the AU.
Such as ensuring a very robust victim and witness protection program, considering the location of the court and assessing the potential security and political challenges it might face if it's based in Juba.
Deng says the court can learn lessons from other international criminal tribunals across the world to draft the statute.
Among those lessons, we think, is the need for a robust victim and witness protection program. Also, a need for an independent defense unit to ensure that those accused are adequately supported in terms of their right to proper defense.
A few months back, South Sudan government officials said they lack the resources needed to begin the process. Deng says the primary responsibility of implementing the justice mechanism lies with the government. And some rights activists say they believe the government is purposely delaying the process. South Sudan government spokesman Michael McQuay denies that charge.
The Constitution is not yet out. And after adoption of the Constitution, the Act will be processed and passed. That will be in conformity with the Constitution, and thereafter, people will begin to operationalize the Act. And it is the Act that will provide the establishment of the hybrid court.
Although Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and other rights groups have repeatedly documented rights abuses in South Sudan, Deng says these findings are not criminal investigations to be used in court. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 3rd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout out this morning to listeners on these our VOA affiliate stations: Radio Life in Lofa County, Liberia; Brela FM in Nigeria; Kisi FM in Tanzania; Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi; and Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Protests turned violent in the South African capital Wednesday. Thousands of demonstrators demanded that President Jacob Zuma resign as a South African judge ordered the release of a state report on corruption in Zuma's administration. The report points to possible evidence of undue influence and calls for the creation of a judicial commission of inquiry. Tuso Kumalo reports for VOA from Pretoria.
The march began peacefully. Thousands of opposition supporters cheered President Jacob Zuma's decision to withdraw his application to halt the release of a report on corruption. The report was compiled by former public protector Tuluma Tonsela following allegations that Zuma had allowed his supporters in the wealthy Gupta family to pick cabinet ministers of their choice in pursuit of their business interests. Protesters said it is time for Zuma to go.
Zuma must fall. Zuma must fall. The NEC must fall today. He's the Tutsi number one of our country. He's ruining our country. He is stealing our money. They must fall.
The situation soon grew violent. Protesters smashed cars and building windows. Police fired rubber bullets to disperse the road crowds. Streets in the capital became no-call zones as demonstrators attacked people trying to leave buildings. Early in the day, Zuma had surprised everyone, including the judges, by dropping his case. On Tuesday, Zuma's legal team fought fiercely in court to block four opposition parties who wanted to be admitted as intervening parties in the case, but the court ruled in favor of the parties. Musi Maimane is the leader of the Democratic Alliance Party.
We can proceed with making sure we hold Jacob Zuma to account and that the people of South Africa will know the absolute truth. It's time now that we take deliberate action as the people of our country.
The Public Protector's Office released the report under court order Wednesday. In it, Madonsela calls for the president to appoint within 30 days a commission of inquiry headed by a judge to further investigate allegations of improper relationships and influence. Several senior government officials and members of the ANC have said the Gupta family have offered them cabinet posts on condition they make decisions favorable to their business interests. Dali Mpofu, chairperson of the left-wing Economic Freedom Fighters Party, said the information in the report could be the final blow to Zuma's rule.
Any proof that he has abdicated his presidential functions to a private party will show that he is not fit for office.
And the thousands who marched in Pretoria agree. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Pretoria.
The World Health Organization warns that millions of people died every year from preventable surgical infections. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. A WHO report says new global guidelines it is issuing for the prevention of surgical site infection will save many lives.
The World Health Organization reports more than 240 million surgical procedures are performed globally every year for a wide range of conditions, including cancer, heart disease, cataracts, and traffic crash injuries. Surgical site infections occur when bacteria enter a patient's body through incisions. They threaten the lives of millions of patients each year and contribute to the spread of antibiotic resistance. The UN agency says says they are the most common hospital-acquired infection in poor countries and the second most common in rich countries. WHO Director of Service Delivery and Safety, Ed Kelly, says one in every 10 surgical patients in poor countries will get an infection. In some countries, he says, one-third of all patients coming in for surgery are infected.
In Africa, for instance, 20% of cesarean sections result in surgical site infections, which endanger, of course, the life of the woman and therefore the life of her baby. These result in hundreds of thousands of extra hospital days, billions of dollars in extra hospital costs, and tens of thousands of deaths.
The new guidelines cover 29 recommendations in 23 areas. Kelly says evidence shows that antibiotics given as close as possible before surgery can prevent infections for certain surgical procedures. But he says using antibiotics after surgery does not prevent infections. Another recommendation, he says, is not to shave patients before surgery.
Hair removal can actually increase the risk of causing microscopic cuts or traumas to the skin. And the evidence tells us that there's clear benefit to not removing the hair. If you had to boil it down globally as to what could have some of the biggest impact, this question of proper site preparation, proper hand hygiene, and really then the layout of the operating theater in terms of preventing infections.
Of the 29 recommendations in the guidelines, health officials cite hand washing as the single most important for preventing surgical site infections. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Experts say countries that are democratic tend to allow national minorities the best environment to use their potential. On the other hand, diasporas in authoritarian states and dictatorships are overwhelmingly oppressed and quiet. Viewer Aman Tajimanya has more.
The United States hosts the most powerful diasporas in the world. The U.S. views diaspora communities as an extremely important resource for the development of the country, says USAID Deputy Assistant Administrator Mona Yakubian.
Diasporas bring experience, they bring expertise, they bring passion, and they bring resources.
The key to the success of diasporas in America is freedom, universally respected in the United States. The community can freely raise its demands and criticize the U.S. government without fear of being suppressed, notes independent expert Armen Kurazian, who has worked in the Armenia diaspora organizations.
It is inconceivable that the United States government would ever exercise any pressure, exert any pressure on the community to change its positions on issues that it has been advocating for.
According to Brian Arduni, executive director of the Armenian Assembly of America, democratic instruments allow diaspora organizations in the United States to let their voices be heard.
It's a democracy, so it often only takes a small group of people to have a significant change.
Unlike the United States, the role of diasporas in the societies of authoritarian states is significantly low. Experts argue that, furthermore, states like Russia attempt to use diasporas as a tool to influence their historical homeland.
Using the community to make sure that the Armenians or the Armenian government do not engage in any activity that, in their view, would present a challenge to Russia's interests or policies.
In the same way, Moscow attempts to use the communities of other former members of the Soviet Union, notes Manuel Orozco, a senior fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue.
To Russia, this may be a political tool to influence certain trends. And it was obviously the case in Moldova. Russia has been very influential of political in foreign policy towards Moldova because of its presence and the role of a large migration flow. It's also been very influential in Georgia.
In 2008.
Still today, Russia is very influential in what goes on in Georgia because of the large influx of migrants or Georgians in Russia.
At the same time, experts have observed that while Moscow uses diasporas in Russia as a tool to influence newly independent states and attempts to restrict the activities of national communities inside Russia, the Russian government is always ready to breach the sovereignty of its neighbors under the false pretenses of protecting the Russian-speaking population in these countries. Arman Terjimanyan, VOA News, Washington.
Here's Samson O'Malley with today's Africa Sports Roundup.
Good morning, James. We begin with a wrap of UEFA Champions League matches played across various venues in Europe on Wednesday. Borussia Dortmund were able to sneak a 1-0 win over Sporting Lisbon in their UEFA Champions League match on Wednesday night, while Italian giant Juventus were held to a 1-1 draw by Lyon. Elsewhere, it was a 37th-minute goal from André Silva that handed FC Porto a slender 1-0 win over Club Brugge at the Estadio do Drago to see the Portuguese side go second in Group G. And a brace from Falcao and goal from Valérie Germain saw Monaco cruise to a comfortable 3-0 win over CSKA Moscow to see the French side go top of Group E. A strong second-half showing from Sevilla saw them back 3 goals to run out comfortable 4-0 winners over Dynamo Zagreb to see the Spanish side go top of Group H. Staying with the UEFA Champions League, both Ghana internationals Jeffrey Shulup and Daniel Amate earned starting roles in Leicester City's UEFA Champions League clash with FC Copenhagen on Wednesday night. The Foxes boss Claudio Ranieri restored Amate to his starting lineup in midfield, while Shulup earned just his second start of the season in all competitions. And to South Africa, where South Africa Football Association president Danny Jordan has told Bafana Bafana legend Neil Tovey not to rush teams as he recovers from a serious heart attack. The 54-year-old suffered a heart attack on the 16th of October while exercising and was rushed to hospital where he spent days in intensive care. It is the second heart attack Turvey has suffered inside 2 years. No African coach was named in the shortlist of the Coach of the Year award just released by FIFA. Leicester City's Claudio Ranieri, Wales boss Chris Fernando Santos, who guided Portugal to their upset victory over France in the Euro 2016 final, all made the 10-man shortlist released ahead of the start of voting on Friday. A final three will be announced on December the 2nd and FIFA will unveil the winner on January the 9th. And to Nigeria, where Chippa United goalkeeper Daniel Akpei has been drafted as replacement for injured Wolves star Carl Ikeme by Super Eagles manager Gerard Rao ahead of next week's 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifying match against Algeria in Uyo on Saturday the 12th of November 2016, following Carl's injuries. Staying with Nigeria, the Nigerian Football Federation has become the first governing body of the game in the African continent to be enlisted on the premium services of the world governing body FIFA domestic transfer marketing system and intermediary regulations tool. Orlando Pirates chairperson Evan Koza has accepted the resignation of coach Mohsin Ertugrul. Ertugrul tendered his resignation after Tuesday night's shocking 6-1 defeat at the hands of SuperSport, who scored all their goals in the space of 37 minutes in the second half of their APSA Premiership fixture. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's decision Tuesday to fire the UN mission in South Sudan, Army's force commander, is long overdue, says South Sudanese analyst. Ban fired Army's force commander, Lieutenant General Johnson Mogoa Kimani Odieki of Kenya, following a UN report released on Tuesday that concluded its peacekeeping force in South Sudan failed to protect civilians and aid workers when fighting broke out in Juba in early July. And that is it for this Thursday, November 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Zara Abuze, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next on Let's Talk. Africa is home to several languages and over 1,000 different ethnic groups. That makes summing up African naming traditions vary significantly. Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing names in Africa. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the historic U.S. presidential election and how the results could change the political landscape in the United States. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.